Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Tuesday at 5. RPM is about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Every week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in NYC. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Good afternoon. This is Amy Wilson. You're listening to a very special episode of Revolutions Per Minute. Revolutions Per Minute is a socialist radio show and podcast produced by members of the New York City chapter of Democratic Socialists of America. To connect with us, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com or sign up for our newsletter to get links to what we talk about on the show. You can do that on our website at revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com. You can also find us on Twitter at NYCRPM. Today we are talking about fascism and anti-fascism. So this is a very special episode. It's a re-record of a show that was broadcast live on July 30th that was the best episode of RPM. Don't you agree? Yeah. Even more so since it's now been lost to time. There's a special quality to things that have been lost. But we felt that fascism and anti-fascism are a topic that's important enough to us as socialist organizers and members of a left community here in New York City that it was essential for us to do our best to get some of these ideas out in front of you once again. So thanks so much for the DSA members who are listening out there. And if you're not a member of DSA, you can always join us. Today we'll touch on some of what we talked about on the show on July 30th. We'll also expand to cover some recent news from both the world of the Democratic Socialists of America and the state of play in anti-fascist organizing across the U.S. So tonight on the show, or whenever you're listening to the show, we will be talking about fascism. What is fascism and anti-fascism? We'll be talking about DSA and anti-fascism. We'll have a report back from our recent national convention, which was held at the beginning of this month. We will talk about recent news from across the country, and then we'll let you know how you can continue learning more and getting involved in the struggle against fascist incursion. I have some guests here in the studio with me today. I'd like to introduce them in just a moment. But first, I'd like to introduce a quote, a concept that has been guiding my approach to organizing since I read it. It comes from labor, a labor organizer named Jane McAlevey, who's very well known in her field, wrote a great book called No Shortcuts. And she says, the craft of organizing helps people connect the dots between the critical solidarity-affirming moment and the larger system it challenges. So although this comes from a different type of organizing than what we're going to be talking about today, I wanted to include it in the show because I feel, and I'd love for the guests to chime in on this, I feel that we are in a critical solidarity-affirming moment when it comes to anti-fascism here today on August 18th, 2019. Would you agree?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Thank you. So thanks again for being here with me. Let's hear a little bit about you and what you're bringing to the show today. So first I have Ruth from Outlive Them NYC.
I'm Ruth. As Amy said, I'm with Outlive Them NYC. I'm an organizer and a founding member of that group.
And what is Outlive Them NYC?
Outlive Them NYC is a group that formed back in November in response to the Pittsburgh pogrom, and we fight against anti-Semitism and racism.
And I'm Isaac, also with Outlive Them NYC. I'm also a member of DSA in North Brooklyn, and I work on, besides anti-fascist-related issues, I work on housing, organizing, and that kind of thing.
Wonderful. Welcome.
And I'm Sophia. I'm also in the NYC DSA, and I'm an organizer around anti-imperialism and Islamophobia. I organize in Brooklyn, and I also do Palestine solidarity work.
Wonderful. Thanks to all of you for being here. And Sophia, you were a delegate to our recent national
convention.
That's right, yeah. Great. So we're going to hear about that a little bit later in the show. Let's dig in to a sort of broad overview of the topic at hand today, fascism. What is it, and what does anti-fascism do to combat it? So I'm wondering if one of you could kick us off.
Yeah, so I mean, a quote I like about to, you know, set the stage for kind of theoretical discussion of what fascism is just simply, fascism is a most ferocious attack by capital on the mass of the working people. Fascism is unbridled chauvinism and predatory war. And this was the quote by, I think his name, Gregory Dimitrov, who was the kind of line of the Comintern and the international kind of anti-fascist movement in the 30s.
So let's say that again. Fascism is a most ferocious attack by capital on the mass of the working people. Fascism is unbridled chauvinism and predatory war.
I also really like this quote by Robert Paxton from his book, The Anatomy of Fascism, in terms of what that means in practice. He says, fascism is a form of political behavior marked by obsessive preoccupation with community decline, humiliation, or victimhood, and by compensatory cults of unity, energy, and purity, in which a mass-based party of committed nationalist militants working in uneasy but effective collaboration with traditional elites abandons democratic liberties and pursues with redemptive violence and without ethical or legal restraints goals of internal cleansing and external expansion. One of the things that I like about this quote is that it elucidates the relationship between non-state fascism and state authoritarianism, and also between street-level fascism and the police.
Absolutely, absolutely. So fascism, in short, is a reactionary philosophy that's tied to economic upheaval, imperialism, state violence, and instability. Sophia, do you have anything you'd like to add to those definitions?
Yeah, I think I would just add that fascism has been used historically as a strategy of the capitalist class when things have gotten out of hand for them. And it's always been linked to colonialism and the white supremacy that is built upon, and the crisis that they face, whether that's an imperial crisis or that's a crisis of, you know, working people rising up in their liberation. And so it's often used like that in, whether that's, you know, Germany and Italy historically, and in other cases as well, Latin America. And you can see those reference points through a number of different transnational fascist movements.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is a transnational movement, as you so elegantly just put it. Keeping those academic and theoretical definitions in mind, I'd like to speak a bit about where we are seeing fascist incursion in our daily lives as people living in the United States in 2019. What is it? Who is being most affected by it? And what does it look like and sound like as well? Fascism is visual. It is aesthetic. So we can see that and incorporate that into our analysis of it as well. So a few of the ways that we see a fascist expression in 2019 might be.
I think a really obvious one is the border policy, which is not only obviously incredibly racist, but the kind of ideological justification that's used by the state for a border policy really explicitly evokes blood and soil and Lebensraum, or literally living room, kind of ideologies that the Nazis also used to justify their incursion into neighboring states.
Mm-hmm. There's been some mainstream analysis of the ways in which rhetoric about invasion has filtered out into the popular imagination and fueled violence, such as the recent shootings in El Paso.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and not to mention the collaboration between the state and kind of far right militia groups that are stationed along the border, and the kind of creation of like extra legal areas in the border where kind of mass violence and dehumanization is to be expected. It's a norm of the kind of region.
In our last time we had this conversation, we talked a lot about the sort of spectrum of violence and dehumanization and how it starts with things that might seem small, like asking people to show their papers, right? And that expands into this overall feeling of unwelcomeness, of otherhood that is the basis of what fascism is trying to accomplish. We see that as well with things like organized fascist groups that have imagery and symbols that they'll post in places. And you may not know what it means, but if you do know what it means, it's there to tell you, be scared.
Yeah, that's one reason why anti-fascist groups will focus on things that might seem, or not focus entirely, but put some energy into things that might seem comparatively small, like tearing down fascist stickers and flyers and putting up their own. It's because they're trying to counteract that that exact feeling of unwelcomeness, the kind of imagery that targets certain groups.
Right, exactly.
I would just add, I think that, especially in the U.S., you have a situation where the far right has grown as a result of the U.S.'s military invasions around the world. And so you see a lot of this, especially, I think, when Obama came into power or, you know, got elected, there were the government was sort of facing a real kind of crisis in terms of retention and recruitment of people to the war in Iraq. It was becoming really unpopular. And so they both needed to, like, talk about ending the war while expanding it in a different way. But part of that meant lowering the requirements for getting in, which allowed a number of white supremacists to enter. Mm. And what happens when they go abroad, they commit atrocities and come back, that violence manifests in what we see today in terms of the militarization of the police is not an accident. It comes from that. It's not an abstraction. And then you end up having a situation where police departments have or entertain white supremacy in their ranks. Certain sections of veterans adopt those and become, you know, sort of part of these far right groupings. And that takes on seeing the internal enemy and who is that. And I think that you see a lot of that in terms of symbols like the secret Facebook group of the Customs and Border Patrol that had the 1015 slogan, which is like their code for aliens in custody. But as you know, half of CBP members are in that Facebook group, and we found out about the dehumanization of immigrants because of the misogyny that AOC and other reps faced and when they went to investigate those facilities. So
right, exactly. And that's a excellent point about the connection there between misogyny and misogynist imagery, the way that that permeates fascist ideology. We were talking a little bit in the coffee shop downstairs about the connection between fascism and patriarchy. So restricting abortion access is also an expression of state violence and control. And that patriarchy is in and of itself racialized in that it valorizes white womanhood and white female domesticity as part of the family unit, and denigrates black and brown women and sees their reproductive capacity as dangerous and threatening. So that is also a huge part of a fascist ideology now and historically.
Yeah, I would just add that there is ongoing organizing, I think, and incipient organizing to defend reproductive justice, obviously, around the country. Just wanted to plug quickly, there is a meeting connecting the far right and its anti-abortion politics and roots and movement. And that's going to be taking place at Verso on September 5th, organized by NYC for Abortion Rights. You can look them up on Facebook, and it'll be at 6:30.
Cool. September 5th.
Yeah.
September 5th. The far right and abortion access.
Yeah.
I think another point about the gendered stuff is that so many of the roots of these current alt-right movements also come from Gamergate, Red Pill ideology, pickup artist culture.
Incel culture.
Incel culture, right. It's very much, they're very much hand in hand. And recently I was reflecting on the Isla Vista massacre that happened in 2014, which was the origin of the sort of social media organizing Yes, All Women. That moment feels so distant now. Mm. It was only 5 years ago in actual time, but where that has gone, it just feels unbelievable. Another aspect of fascist expression that we're going to be talking about certainly later in the show is street fascism, and as Sophia alluded to, the documented connections between police and far-right organizers. It is not a secret. It's out there. That's something that we'll touch on later. One thing that I personally have been following with great interest is the resolution recently introduced by Ted Cruz. Let's try that again. The resolution recently introduced by Ted Cruz.
Boo
Ted Cruz. To criminalize and anti-fascist organizing, to suggest that anti-fascists are domestic terrorists. What does that mean? Where is that leading? I think is a mm-hmm. really live question right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think it just reflecting on what happened in Portland this past week, and I think you're seeing a shift in strategy by some of the far-right street fascists to kind of support the criminalization of anti-fascism mm-hmm. and try and, I mean, everyone out in Portland had video cameras and their cell phones out recording things and trying to, you know, be the next person on Tucker Carlson with some, like, kind of misleading video, trying to support the kind of designation of Antifa as some kind of, like, mass extremist organization. And I think that's only leading to something like another J20, where there's, like, going to be a, you know, kind of mass arrests of people based on, like, flimsy signifiers, like, wearing mask or wearing black or just being next to other people.
And I think the Portland, the mayor and the city were kind of emphasizing that the stuff around masks was like, you know, a major kind of talking point for them as an excuse to like kind of hide the fact that they, you know, the police actively helps Patriot Prayer and other organizations kind of get access to the streets. And I'd also say like it is, heightened because Trump himself makes those arguments.
Exactly.
And so it's like the sitting president is kind of aiding that. And it's not Ted Cruz's first time making sort of a statement like this. In 2017, a few months after, or right around when Trump got elected, he introduced a bill that would try to designate the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization, mm-hmm. just sort of in tandem with Egypt and Saudi Arabia and other dictatorships that were trying to clamp down on protest and organizing and activism by using the bogeyman of all the Muslim Brotherhood, there's going to take over, and we have our war on terror. And you can see that manifest in attacks on Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib. That hasn't ended. And I think it's important that the left in the U.S. understands that if it takes the lessons from from Black Lives Matter, who've been designated as Black identity extremists by the FBI, and from Muslims who've also faced that. It's not only like this isn't the first time, but also this is also our basis for solidarity. We have to be able to remember these links and try to join up. Because my fear is Antifa is becoming this like radioactive term, mm-hmm. and people get sort of getting scared by that and trying to shy away from even identifying with anti-fascism.
I think it's worth noting, too, that even if that Senate resolution, whether it passes or not, is a little immaterial for what I think the purpose of it is, because from what I understand about how things like RICO charges actually work, even if that resolution passed, it would be very difficult to legally enforce it. Even just based on the actual lack of structure of Antifa, because it isn't an organization in which FBI investigators could embed themselves for 10 years, and thus, because it's not actually a cohesive organization. But I think the utility of the the Senate resolution is for exactly what you're saying, for deterrence. You know, the more that it becomes difficult for people who are vulnerable in other ways to feel comfortable showing up for something like a mass mobilization, the more unsafe it will become for anybody to engage in anti-fascist organizing. So I feel like that's the angle that that Ted Cruz is coming from.
Yeah, right, exactly. And Donald Trump very much so, I hate the words that are about to come out of my mouth. I hate that I'm talking about Donald Trump's tweets, but this one in particular is relevant to the discussion in that there was a big fascist rally in Portland, Oregon yesterday, August 17th, and he tweeted in the morning, Antifa are domestic terrorists, and then all the group chats of all the people who are there at the rally or watching the rally, they light up and say, the president is with us. Mm-hmm. The president is with us today. He is on our side. And they're not wrong. Mm-hmm. And they're not making something out of nothing. It's as clear as day. And I'm glad, again, that you brought up Ilhan Omar. When we recorded this, the first version of the show, it was just a few days after the infamous rally where the chance to send her back happened. And that was an example for many of us and many of our listeners as well, who were able to call in at that time, as a shocking visual demonstration of fascist ideology.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I feel like, the impact of Charlottesville and people standing up after that, when people started denouncing Trump for supporting Nazis, was a really important moment, because it sort of redirected and sort of said, this is the kind of white supremacy that he's trying to build up, and we need to organize against it. Heather Heyer's mother coming out around that. And then you had this incredible mass mobilization in Boston that, you know, literally was like Black Lives Matter, the Massachusetts Teachers Union asking its members to go out into the rally, the ACLU Massachusetts calling people to go to the rally. It was this sort of moment where you had labor and all these community groups and the march starting in a historically Black neighborhood and ending in the main kind of downtown area. And it was 40,000 people against like 50 or 30 of their side. And it was this sort of incredible, incredibly like effort. And I think that, you know, it's been shown that like sort of doxing and the kind of taking down YouTube videos and the lawsuits have had an impact on kind of getting, you know, some of the Nazis back into the shadows. But I still feel like the fact that Trump continues to go out and or like to his rallies around the country and didn't stop doing that, spent a lot of time around the country rallying, means that the main sort of mobilizer and source of confidence for all of these fascists is still his rallies. Mm. I think that's what it really represented. And like, there's a stat that like hate crimes in 2016 skyrocketed over 200% in counties where Trump rallied. And so to me, it's sort of a question of like, also the source of confidence and unity among these people. They, you know, this is their legitimacy. And it just reminds me of the rally that they just had in Pennsylvania at the Shell plant, where they the union forced its members to attend, the steam fitters local union forced its members to go to a Trump rally or they wouldn't get paid overtime.
Right.
And it's sort of like this thing where our unions don't have any members don't have control over their unions. Their unions concede to the bosses. They don't actually fight and unite people. And not only that, like they're literally allowing white supremacist ideas to kind of infiltrate in the union movement and be legitimized and normalized. And so that kind of adds a sort of question of like, how do we organize in those spaces too?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially as socialists and leftists who are present in the labor movement already. These are not two separate issues, because nothing is separate issues. Actually, that's my bias. I'm very into the connections between everything. And I think that our organizing only becomes stronger when we're able to get out from false divisions. Let's speak a little bit now, unless the three of you have anything else you want to add about what does fascism look like in 2019? Okay. It looks awful. It really does. I don't mean that to be whimsical or disrespectful to the fact that there is violence of all types occurring, but I do just want to leave some space in this discussion to recognize that the feelings that all of this produces in us as individuals are real and worthy of discussion in a moment like this. And perhaps later we can talk about what that actually means as organizers and the ways in which we take care of each other as we engage in this work. So what is anti-fascism? So we talked a little bit about fascism. What is anti-fascism? One thing that we know, and now people all over the country know as anti-fascism, is street organizing. But let's speak a little bit about what else anti-fascism comprises.
Anti-fascism is countering fascism by any means necessary and by what are the appropriate means. I feel like it's really important to make that distinction because the first statement is nice and militant, but I think maybe for some people listening might sound a little extreme. But by any means necessary, I mean that, like, most anti-fascism you might not even hear about unless you follow certain Twitter accounts that are putting out calls to, you know, okay, call this person's place of work and get them fired, or there's going to be an event at this venue, call this venue and ask them to cancel it.
Exactly. And what do we call that?
We deplatforming. I feel like that's where anti-fascism starts. Like the things that get the most press, as we saw yesterday, are, you know, are direct confrontation and violence, and, you know, secondary to that, mass mobilization. Like, and I guess because that's the most exciting, so that gets the most play in mainstream media. But, like, the best kind of anti-fascism is the stuff you can do safely and anonymously, and you don't have to show up for in person at all. That any kind of direct confrontation is the last resort, and it's sometimes an appropriate tactic, but it's certainly not the first line of defense.
And when we see something like what happened in Portland yesterday, we also know that that is the result of weeks and weeks of preparation from those groups. To organize people, to show up is work, to train people as protest medics, marshals, to be prepared to do jail support, to do all of these other sort of within the ecosystem of anti-fascism that is required for the street actions to be possible.
That's one reason why it upsets me so much when this is even something that people on the left sometimes say, or people who call themselves people on the left, who criticize anti-fascism as LARPing or something that people do just to kind of be glamorous and look badass. And that's just, it's so not the case. Most anti-fascist work is not glamorous. And even for mass mobilizations, like you're saying, Amy, so much is just infrastructural support to make sure that everybody showing up that day can be safe.
Yeah, I think it's also like Sophia said, you know, I mean, a lot of times it requires like mass mobilization, you know, mass movement across all fronts. I mean, you know, I'm talking about fighting it on the kind of, you know, cultural side of things, fighting it in terms of like intergroup solidarity work, in terms of anti-racist organizing, in terms of immigrant justice solidarity work, you know, in terms of in your trade union, in your workplace generally, in your neighborhood, you know, requires the kind of whole playing field focused around that, requires that, and also requires, you know, a kind of political standpoint. I think it's, like, very important that anti-fascism is clearly anti-capitalist, that it maintains, you know, a clear political explanation that, you know, kind of counters the fascist ideology that you know, provides a kind of alternative to the explanation that fascism points out, that you're kind of, you know, economic situation is due to some kind of racial reason or
right.
some kind of, you know, relating to immigration or that kind of thing, instead of putting out the explanation that, you know, it has to do with the forces of capital itself.
Absolutely. Anti-fascism is anti-capitalism, and I think we can pause there and talk about that a little bit more. Because why should we care about anti-fascism as members of the Democratic Socialists of America? How does this relate to our existing organizing and the organizing that we do in other sectors of society to build socialism and to challenge capitalism? So one of the ways in which anti-fascism is anti-capitalism is pointing out the fact that people are making money off of this violence, right? That there are companies that provide the weaponry, the machinery, the technology. That's a big issue right now, organizing against companies like Palantir. Boo! Like Facebook.
Boo!
Amazon. Say it again.
Amazon.
Boo. Yeah. Right? That we're seeing now sort of bringing to light the supply chain of fascism and all the people and actors who are involved in making it possible and challenging each step of the way.
Yeah, and also challenging the ways in which those individuals from those companies are able to hide their money in what I like to call art washing. A great example of this recently is Warren Kander is finally leaving the board at the Whitney, though he's far from the only suspect person on that board, or any other arts board for that matter, because it's an incredibly common thing that people do is set themselves up as cultural philanthropists when their money is extremely ill-gotten.
Exactly.
So groups like Decolonize This Place that have had sustained campaigns around that are doing really incredible work.
Can you say, for those who may not be familiar with this, where Warren Kander's money came from?
Warren Kander's is the CEO of Safariland Group, which is an arms manufacturing company. They've made, among other things, tear gas that was used at the border against refugees, and also in Puerto Rico against the recent protesters, and also in the occupied territories in Palestine, in Israel. They also manufacture bullets that have been shot at Palestinians.
Right. Somebody is making all of these things.
And even the name Safariland is like your sort of white settler colonial dream. You know, it's just like, we will transport you to Africa to go shoot people and for sport. Yeah. I would also just add, going, that anti-fascism is also needs to be seen as, this is the way that we defend our working class communities, and this is how we defend our gains from being taken away. And it is a culture. And just going back to referencing the Jane McAlevey quote, she has a sort of argument that you need to have a whole worker organizing strategy. Literally every person has to be accounted for. Where are they at? It's not enough for you simply to have the best activists or organizers on board. But it's really going to take is having everyone on your side, because that's what's going to matter. It's really just two reference points. I mean, the El Paso shooter, for example, there was a lot of talk. I think there's a lot of tendency to say, don't give him enough attention. And I think that I understand where that comes from in terms of like the media and the way it humanizes white supremacists. But it is important to look at the ideas that that compel them to commit these massacres. And when you look at the manifesto, the entire argument he has is he wants to kill immigrants who are Latinx because he thinks that the left wants open borders and universal health care, and there's not enough to go around, mm-hmm. sort of eco-fascism strain. And it's not going to be enough to deport people. Basically, he wants to call for a genocide because that's going to make lives livable for white native, white Americans. And he has this whole thing. It's extremely all over the place, but this whole thing where he's like, open borders will lead to automating jobs, and I will lose out, and universal health care is the way they're going to do that, and universal basic income, there won't be enough. And so with all these ideas that he has, he's like, I'm just going to go. And then he flips and he talks about the kinds of assault weaponry that could be effective. And I think it's important to say those ideas against open borders are out there. We in DSA have committed ourselves to defending and supporting open borders. We believe in international socialist world. And it's going to take a lot to convince ordinary people that that's not only possible, but that's exactly what we need. And like, it's really the 1%. You know, there's more than enough to go around. We're fighting for all the things that we need. And I just think that one thing I would say is that the way we talk about anti-fascism is very tactically oriented. And I think it's good to have marshals and people who can organize that. But I do think you're going to, like, anti-fascism has to be seen as, like, this is how, like, defending communities in, you know, in New York against ICE raids is an anti-fascist activity.
Right.
You know, speaking out against rape culture on campuses is an anti-fascist activity. People don't think of these things that way. And I think we have to redefine what it even means to call yourself anti-fascist and what you do.
Mm. Absolutely. I think that's, I agree.
That's something we've focused on quite a bit in Outlive Them is solidarity with people fighting against ICE and also against police violence, because we see this as part of the same issue, both like materially and ideologically.
And Outlive Them, just to elucidate a little bit of the approach, is an explicitly Jewish organization, right?
Yeah, it's open to Jews and allies, but most people in it are Jewish, and we ground our anti-fascist work in the long tradition of Jewish leftism that was pretty much obliterated during the Red Scare.
Right. And so coming from that background, that shared religious and spiritual belief into solidarity with other groups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's worth noting, too, that most mainstream Jewish activism focuses on Israel-Palestine, which I think is absolutely an important cause that everybody should be involved with. But I've always found it interesting that not all people involved in that kind of solidarity work extended the same kind of analysis to things going on right in front of us, mm-hmm. in New York City, because I see the same kind of colonial settler forces that are incredibly oppressive towards people in the occupied territories in Israel. That same kind of ideological basis is used to oppress people right here. So I'm an internationalist as well, and I think that as a Jew, I want to fight where I stand, not just in solidarity with Palestinians.
And also with a connection to some of the other organizing that you do, Isaac, and working on building tenant power. Ruth's mention of the fights that we have here in New York City, that's one of the greatest and most poignant one. Fortunately, we've had some victories in the last 6 months or so. But when we talk about building tenant power, that is also anti-fascist work.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also, you know, about... I mean, like you said, like the kind of preserving the gains and that kind of thing. I mean, there's, you know, no doubt that, there's a lot of racism involved in kind of everyday life as a tenant in New York City, and you know, there's certainly you know, evictions and that kind of thing every day that have to do with that kind of you know, and I think it's about, you know, building up, I mean, you know, building up this forms of solidarity that go beyond just one thing, right, and go throughout your entire life, throughout your, you know, solidarity with you know, tenants as a whole, solidarity with, you know, workers as a whole, that kind of thing. And that's when you get to the kind of, you know, whole worker, whole sphere of life, and you get to, you know, anti-fascist life. It's all good.
Right. Sophia found the key to my heart by saying whole worker.
Oh, my God. I just, like, it was in my mind. But just to add to that, something that I was reading an article today about Portland and Oregon and how that state was historically sort of seen as sort of like a haven for white only settlement.
Mm-hmm.
And black people were banned from even living there until 1926, which is insane to think about.
Yep.
But there was sort of a quote about how that meant that the far right could actually grow and kind of deepen its roots in the white working class, because there was absolutely almost, you know, minimal sort of diversity or interaction with people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And that explains the continued convergence of the far right with law enforcement and these kinds of episodes of violence, and the kind of, you know, the more resolute culture of anti-fascism there that understands these reasons. But just to link to that, I do think it's important because in some way it's connected to fighting for tenants and for people of color to stay in the communities that they've made in places where they've been displaced, and how gentrification can actually produce the same conditions in urban cities like New York that are black and brown cities, but people are being displaced and pushed out. And there's a sort of it opens the ground for some a section of white sort of gentrifiers who, in the kind of mold of Vice and Gavin McGinnis, are sort of this part of this edgelordy kind of vibe and culture that allows for alt-right ideas to take hold that are racist, that are anti-feminist, that are homophobic. And you kind of, again, see like manifestations of this with Proud Boys, being able to like just go around the streets in Midtown and beat people up. And so I really think that we should think about housing rights work as part of that. Like, we are trying to defend the right of working class communities to live here free of violence, and, you know, not let the far right take root.
Right, exactly. And if one, so going back to the way we opened this discussion, if one of the purposes of fascism is to divide the working class, then forming working class institutions and building working class power is anti-fascism.
Mm-hmm.
So being that we're here today with one of our comrades who served as a delegate to the Democratic Socialists of America National Convention, which happened at the beginning of this month, and given that there was a resolution passed at that convention to form a DSA National Anti-Fascist Working Group, let's hear a little bit about that resolution, a little bit about the debate that surrounded it, and what that reflects as to sort of the current state of mind in DSA, as much as we can speak to it from our perspective here as people, as much as we can speak to it, the relationship between DSA and anti-fascist organizing. So would you mind starting us off?
Yeah, I also want to say that I have not been as involved in anti-fascist organizing in DSA, so just wanted to put that out there. But the resolution was put forward by some members in Portland and some members who I think were not, and it was, I think, kind of vague. It called for establishing a national anti-fascist working group and a direct action working group, and part of it was noted that it, you know, as leftists, we, you know, we have a responsibility to be able to fight for communities that are marginalized, that are usually, you know, at the very front of attacks by the far right, and that it would set up an online secure platform that would help coordinate information and provide trainings to members about how to organize against fascism. And, you know, over 1,000 delegates were in Atlanta, and I feel as though when I went in, I was like, oh, this is obvious. Of course I'd support it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's not the top priority of everybody in DSA, but, you know, didn't make the consent agenda, but maybe, you know, whatever. Like, I didn't think there was going to be a major debate for some reason. I think there was because of a number of things, and I think they got largely confused. One where the people were had reservations about this sort of information security aspect. They were like, we don't know what it's calling for. It felt it felt very vague. It was sort of, what is this platform? Could it be leaked? Could we, you know, how would we protect ourselves?
Right.
And the other element being, I think that people were saying, had the back of their mind this sort of Ted Cruz kind of Trumpian threat.
Right.
That what's going to happen if DSA gets in the target of this attack on Antifa? And I think the subtext was, we don't want to have anything to do with it. And the problem was, when we got to the debate, and I talked to one comrade of color who was like, I'm worried about what if DSA gets doxxed, or what if DSA gets subpoenaed? We don't know how to protect our members. And, you know, this is just a thing to think about. DSA also has undocumented members and so on.
Sure, absolutely.
And, yeah, on the one end, the people who were against this resolution, it seemed to be, surprisingly for me, had more comrades of color and more queer comrades. Mm. And the optics of it didn't look quite good. And within that section, some people were saying, I think the idea was Antifa is a tactic and we don't want to be going around, you know, whatever. I think the notion that Antifa is about attacking people with milkshake and having rifles has really caught on. I think it's a problem of lack of a better word, branding of Antifa.
Political education.
Yeah, political education, exactly.
And also I think that the media is mainstream media is very responsible for that.
Right, and the way it covers this stuff. But the other aspect was, this comrade from Kentucky, who was a trans comrade, came up and was very emotional and said their chapter had been attacked. And it kind of escalated where they were like, I just think that we should remove the word anti-fascism from this, and I would amend it. And I was like, okay, this is getting really bad. So I stood up to defend it, because I knew this is a very, like, again, this is like a McCarthyism component. If you start disassociating yourself from the word, are you a communist? Are you anti-fascist? Are you this or that? You're weakening the ground for defending yourself. And so I was like, all right, I have a few arguments to make or whatever. I'm going to get on the mic. And I asked, there were two people in the front, and they were both white and white women. And I was like, you know, we were encouraged to use progressive stack. And I was like, I'd like to speak on this, you know, as a Muslim, and also, like, optics were bad.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the comrades, they were both, like, hesitant. They didn't want to give me the mic. And they were like, one of them was like, this is my issue. And I was like, oh, okay. This is really bad. And I got frustrated in the moment, exasperated, to be honest. And I was like, you know, you're going to lose if you go this way. And I got frustrated, and eventually, like, we didn't even get to the mic to speak at some point, because they'd called to question, and luckily we voted. But everyone there who was for it had extreme reservations about this, for those reasons. And I spoke later to a comrade in Austin who was like, you know, I just had reservations about this and who was putting it forward, but I voted for it because my chapter told me to vote for it. And they told me to vote for it because a DSA member was in an IBEW local in Austin, Texas, and Antifa activists let us know that there was a Nazi in the local of our union, of this union. And that helped our DSA member to help kick out the Nazi from our local. And I was like, God, this is what we should have had in the convention floor.
Yeah. Right.
Something concrete that tells you that. And I was like, that's what we mean by anti-fascism. And my only thing to say is that I hope that the working group, now that it's been put forward, can think more creatively, because there are people who are genuinely want to organize against the alt-right and fascism. I think we have to be creative about that. What that means to me is, how do we have conversations with our labor commission? We have one now that's committed to the rank and file strategy. How do we have conversations about having our unions put forward resolutions against membership by Nazis, mm-hmm. and all the organizations are affiliated with, Patriot Prayer and Proud Boys and so on. How do we have sanctuary union resolutions mm-hmm. that affirm our support for immigrants? How do we have a conversation about how the AFL-CIO still has police unions and the Border Patrol union in the AFL-CIO, and how do we build a campaign nationally to kick them out, especially if Sarah Nelson, who's the air flight attendant president of the union and who's also trying to speak out more and fight around the use of aviation to deport people. How do we build enough of an on-the-ground mobilization and make DSA a place where, if she were to be elected the AFL-CIO president, there is a mandate to kick them out of these unions and really do the thing that prevents them from being normalized in everyday life. And that's a kind of like anti-fascist broad mobilization that I want DSA to think creatively about with this working group.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been reading recently about the history of Rock Against Racism and the Anti-Nazi League in Britain in the 70s, which was a very, very significant, very large mass movement against the National Front and against fascism in the United Kingdom, that was primarily organized by left-wing groups, radical left-wing groups, but had
socialists
Socialist Workers' Party, but had tremendous success. I mean, they had concerts where the Clash was playing and that kind of thing, and I mean, really, really kind of tremendously successful at creating this kind of very broad, very creative anti-fascist movement, anti-fascist culture that kind of went beyond a kind of liberal analysis to go into this kind of movement against forces of the forces that create kind of British racism, forces that create British imperialism. It was this kind of multiracial, multi-ethnic, working class anti-fascist movement, and they included locals in their Anti-Nazi League included members of soccer team. I think they're called football clubs in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, I think they are called football clubs.
but it was Tottenham Hotspur against the Nazis. They had unions form anti-Nazi locals, so they're rail workers against the Nazis. I mean, the National Front had control of some locals in a bunch of unions across England, and they successfully through rank and file anti-fascists kicked all these Nazis out of the unions in the United Kingdom. There was even pubs against the Nazis back then, and I think that that's something I think that's that kind of campaign is something that DSA can really, really get involved in with this working group, and that's something I would like to see with this working group, frankly.
Yeah, it seems like something that's both material and ideological. It's like creating a culture that's hostile to these forces as well as cutting off their access to institutional and social power.
Absolutely. And I'm glad to hear you both say that in this conversation, because it's something that I hadn't thought about as much for myself. I think that at least in the text of the resolution, as I read it, I'm just skeptical of national level working groups in general. And so I found myself sort of in a sort of push-pull position where I was like, hyper-local organizing is the thing. That's what I'm all about. At the same time, we do need to pool our resources and also understand the different conditions that people are organizing within throughout the United States. So what we have here in New York City is one thing that we've been talking about over the course of the show. What a DSA chapter, what the Middle Tennessee DSA chapter is doing, and what potential fascist incursion they might be handling is much different. And yet we could possibly use some of the same tactics or the same resources, the same education, the same ideas. And so that is one thing for me that supports the idea of bringing this to the national level of DSA, where it hadn't really been before. I don't know if I could name the other national level working groups, but I believe healthcare,
immigrants' rights,
rights,
eco-socialism.
Okay.
Right. The other thing I think just, eco-socialism is going to be very important because a component of that is trying to organize for a just transition for workers who will be impacted by transition from fossil fuel-based industries. And that was part of the El Paso Shooters Manifesto, too. And so being very political and trying to organize around that is going to be as important, because part of anti-fascism is you have to project an alternative that is compelling and that can... for working class people, especially when all signs point to the fact that we will have another recession coming soon. Mm.
Yeah. I mean, I think climate imperialism is going to be a very real thing. Mm-hmm. When you look at the, the effects of climate change are going to be worse in areas closer to the tropics, closer to the equator.
It already is.
Yeah. Already is. Yeah, absolutely. And what's the, right. What relevance does that have in talking about, extractivism and, forces of, how the U.S. military has historically been used to ensure, cheap transport and cheap plunder of the global South's raw materials. That's an issue that's, only going to get worse, I think, under climate change, under, climate imperialism and that kind of thing. And, imperialism, without imperialism, you don't have fascism, right? That is, without colonialism, you don't have fascism.
Mm-hmm, right.
Amy Césaire said something like, colonialism created a little Hitler inside all of us. That's something that's, that's only going to get more salient as the earth gets hotter and hotter.
Absolutely. And as that also spurs the migration of people.
Mm-hmm.
So we're coming to the end of the time that we've set aside for this discussion. And I do want to, there's a note that I think we could leave on. But before we get there, I do want to underscore some of the concerns that were raised around the anti-fascist working group resolution, specifically related to the word anti-fascist and the way in which that might endanger organizers in DSA, which I think is always something we should be aware of, and we should not put vulnerable comrades in positions where they might become more vulnerable. That's organizing 101. That said, some of the arguments that I heard watching on the live stream were that that may happen regardless of whether have an anti-fascist working group. In Portland yesterday, we had Portland DSA marching as a contingent, as openly DSA. That's happening across the country as it should be happening. We are involved in anti-fascist organizing, and I think that we need to respond to that and take our own advice about community defense. But my personal opinion is that we cannot and we should not back away from the use of the word anti-fascist. And I'm wondering if you, as my DSA comrades, have anything that you want to add to that.
Yeah, I would just say, Ilhan Omar does not identify as anti-fascist. That has not stopped Trump from attacking her. It doesn't matter what she says. She could just be like, we're progressive. Well, she does. She doesn't even identify as a democratic socialist, even mm-hmm. though she's so close to our politics and actually pushing them forward. But it's enough for her to be a black immigrant Muslim woman and to be targeted in these rallies. And I think that we should take a note from that. It's like we should be instead be defining exactly what anti-fascism means by saying the real people should be on the defensive are these white supremacists. And we're going to continue to be in solidarity with everyone who's attacked by them. And I just think of Ilhan Omar a lot when I hear this argument. It's like, it doesn't matter what you do. She is as visible gets. Mm-hmm. She could be doing anything or nothing and she'd still be attacked.
Right. Absolutely.
I wanted to add, I'm not in DSA, but as an anti-capitalist organization, DSA is focused on doing something that is removing some of the power base by which fascism establishes itself. And I think that's part of the reason why even parts of DSA that aren't explicitly anti-fascist have been subject to fascist incursion. The IWW Hall, where the DSA in Portland met, was attacked by fascist groups. So one of the common adages in anti-fascist work is Antifa is self-defense. Mm-hmm. If there are people who are involved in something where they're being attacked by fascists, then they should probably be engaged in self-defense.
And not just self-defense, but community defense, right? Mm-hmm. That understanding that there are, we live by the value of solidarity, right? And that's something that informs the work that we do, and that's something that we can't step back from as organizers. I'm from Portland, Oregon, originally. That's where I grew up. And so this weekend has been a challenging one for me. Personally, I think it's been challenging for all of us and people around the country to be following the news, certainly for people who are on the ground in Portland. I will say that seeing the images of riot cops on streets and street corners where essentially I grew up is awful, right? It's fascism is visual. Fascism is visual. Those images are what stick with me. And that said, I think that when we talk about what happened in Portland, what has happened in other places, what may continue to happen, for me, what I find most productive to focus on is what made this possible, right? Yesterday was one day, but it was the result of conditions that are in effect now and will be in effect tomorrow. So if there's one thing that I want to leave the listeners of this show with, that would be it, is that we look at this. It's easy to write it off as street theater or LARPing, as you alluded to, Ruth, but it is not. It is the expression of the conditions that we are living under in the summer of 2019 in the United States.
If I could just add, like, it's not the first time that a label or an identity has been seen as, like, something you want to, like, shy away from, but every time you do, you're actually enabling the right. Mm-hmm. It wasn't too long ago when you couldn't call yourself a feminist because you'd be like, you're feminazi kind of argument. And people are confident enough and proud to call themselves feminists right now and say this is actually about all of our liberation and has a lot to do with, you know, just a bunch of organizing that's been happening to push that. It wasn't too long ago you couldn't call yourself a socialist.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It wasn't too long ago you couldn't call yourself, you know, like even like an anti-Zionist. You'd be told, why do you hate Jewish people instead of why? Like, I actually hate settler colonialism. And like, to be Palestinian was extremely like was demonized and vilified. Could cost you your job and so on.
Well,
it still does.
Yeah.
And I just think like we have to understand the demonization of Antifa and anti-fascism in the same strand of like, we will win if we like make sure that we can mobilize enough people and define this term so that everyone feels a stake and an ownership in identifying that way. Other countries have other traditions like no pasaran, they shall not pass. Like, obviously the Jewish community embraces, you know, as is obvious, but it's just like in the US, it, the fight against fascism was like, yeah, America, you know, like when World War II. And it's like we actually do have a tradition here that is like against the Klan, that is you know, within the civil rights movement, that is Jewish, that is, you know, and now, you know, that is like connected to indigenous folks fighting for their lands against settler colonialism. That's our identity. That's what we should be putting out there, is like, this is what it means to be anti-fascist and you should take ownership of it.
Exactly. When we, as a United States cultural tradition, when we think about combating fascism, we think about doing it over there, and we won.
Yeah, and as the military.
Exactly.
Yeah,
it's problematic. The tropes that we have existing are problematic for many reasons. So as we come toward the end of our discussion here, I want to underscore that if anti-fascism is community defense, then we each know what we are in defense of. And that's something that's also been sustaining for me this weekend is, you know, I told Ruth I was at the playground yesterday in my neighborhood and I was watching the kids playing on the swings and in the water spouts and thinking, you know, the right of these kids who live in NYCHA housing to grow up and have full and safe and happy and healthy lives is what I'm here for, right? That it's my neighbors, it's members of the human community that motivates me personally to be anti-fascist, because fascism presents a direct challenge to the right of those kids to grow up and live full, happy, healthy, productive lives. So if there is something that motivates you as part of a community to defend your community as an anti-fascist, I'll leave the space open to share it.
You know, this past year I was working in I was working in a legal clinic in Crown Heights, and a lot of folks, you know, I just think of, like, you know, a lot of folks there who were coming in because they were, you know, I mean, they're losing their houses after living in that same neighborhood for 30 years and losing that community and being forced to relocate to, like, you know, the Rockaways or something like that. And, you know, just thinking about your, you know, ability to have some kind of, you know, control over the community you live in as a working class person, you know, the ability to have some kind of, you know, voice in shaping that community. And how much, you know, the forces of the right, you know, are, you know, aimed at destroying that voice and silencing that voice.
The people that I always see fighting the hardest for liberation, whether it's in anti-fascism or any other kind of resistance movement, are always, always the people fighting the hardest are the most marginalized people. They're the queer people, the people of color, working class people, because they're fighting for their lives. We are fighting for our lives. And when I see how hard street level fascism in the state lashes back against that, it makes me so angry because I want to live in the world where we don't have to fight for the basic fundamental non-state given right, the basic fundamental right to live a full life, to be a full person, to not have to fight so hard just to be recognized as a valid human being. And that's the world that I want to live in, is where my most marginalized comrades aren't the ones, you know, repeatedly being beaten back by these reactionary forces. I want to live in that better world. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I've grown up under the shadow of the war on terror my whole life, and I didn't expect to, for whatever reason, I didn't expect to continue to live in a world where there are war on terror, quote-unquote, against Muslims in every country right now, whether that's Europe, the U.S., India, against Kashmiris and a settler colonial program of ethnic cleansing there. That explicitly is Islamophobic, and in Saudi Arabia and Egypt, China, there's concentration camps mm-hmm. against Uyghur Muslims. And it just feels as though there is obviously a unifying kind of ideology within that is shared by fascists on the far right and also centrist neoliberal governments and authoritarian governments. And it is Islamophobia. And it is the continued expansion of imperial wars and conquest. And for me, really, the obligation is this is what anti-fascism for me is about, building a world where we can breathe and we can live and that understands that these, you know, again, this massive state power and coordination has to be dismantled. And, like, the weapons exchanges, the arms sales, the governments, you know, the ideology has to be has to be dismantled. And I feel like for the first time in a while, you know, things are really scary, but I also feel like in the U.S., we do have some possibilities, and I don't want that light to be snuffed out. I want, like, our historical memories and our organizing and our solidarity to win out, and that's what motivates me.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here and for sharing in this discussion. And it's August 18th, 2019. This has been a very special episode of Revolutions Per Minute. This is a podcast produced by New York City Democratic Socialists of America. And we hope that we can count on you to show up, to be anti-fascist, and to help us build a better world where working class people can breathe.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Thank you.